we as analysts really need to use our psychoanalytic understanding of the value of the inner life of every individual and of the value of growth and development that occurs in a relationship. We need to use that kind of knowledge to find alternative ways other than the intensive treatment we offer in our offices, not only in developing countries, but also in our own country.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This podcast was created in order to share with our colleagues and the community at large the many activities that psychoanalysts are involved in around the world that go beyond their individual clinical work in their consulting rooms. We have conversations with psychoanalysts who work with medically ill patients, who work in refugee centers, who work in community mental health centers, who work with police departments, with the United Nations, with business leaders, analysts who teach undergraduates, who work in prisons. There's a whole variety of quite remarkable work that analysts are bringing to various venues around the world. When COVID struck us all, we shifted our attention and we began meeting with analysts and talking with analysts again around the world to learn firsthand how they were dealing with this crisis and with the sudden shift to online treatment. And we've learned that different cultures, analytic cultures and political cultures, entail both similarities and differences among each other in how we're all facing this crisis. As part of that effort, we also began speaking with some of the elders in our field. And by elders, I mean those who've been practicing analysis for 40 to 50 years. And we asked them to reflect on this quite unique period of history and to also share their vision of our profession and how it's evolved for them over their many decades. In addition, psychoanalysis has always had a point of view about the societies in which we live. And we've been discussing with clinicians and psychoanalytic researchers on this new wave of othernesses that has been almost virus-like in wrapping the world, where groups of people from all vantage points are being treated as cold others. And there's something about our common humanity that is more and more difficult for us to hold on to. And analysts have a great deal to say about that, and we've been discussing that with colleagues, again, from around the world. And we're going to continue focusing on these three areas: work that analysts do off the couch, reflections on what COVID is doing to all of us, and hopefully what it will be like for us as we leave COVID hopefully behind, and also the reflections that we analysts have on the societies in which we live. I hope you enjoy these conversations. Please feel free to comment on our website, ipaoffthecouch.org. And thank you for listening. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my guest today is Dr. Alexandra Harrison. Dr. Harrison is a training and supervising analyst at the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute in both adult and child psychoanalysis. She is the co-founder and president of a nonprofit called Supporting Child Caregivers. Our conversation today will be based on the work of this program, Supporting Child Caregivers. We discussed what altruism means in all of our lives and its origins in our childhoods, based on a paper that Dr. Harrison wrote in 2017. And she walks us through her early education in infant development and how she, with great enthusiasm, brought that knowledge to working in El Salvador in an orphanage. And she very generously describes her learning curve when she first arrived there and did her thing and then got feedback and had to learn to play the music of the local community and the local caregivers that she was working with. And she describes it with great warmth and a real humility about what it means to work in a foreign culture. She tells us about the surprises she encounters. She describes the evolution of her appreciation of the power of trauma. And she also describes the what she calls magic moments that can be transformative in people's lives, not only the patients, the recipients of the care, but also the caregiver. And we close with a conversation about her work in Pakistan. She gives a clinical example of how she uses her knowledge of the inner life, this infant development that she spent her whole career learning and developing, and how she applies it on a Zoom engagement with a new family in Pakistan. It's very moving. Dr. Harrison is an assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, and she has an adult and child psychoanalytic and psychiatric private practice. She's very involved, as you might imagine, in furthering infant research, working with colleagues, and she specializes in working with families and treating children with autistic spectrum disorders. She has written widely. A number of her papers are listed with the show notes, and she has lectured extensively throughout the world. What you're about to hear, I find not only moving and very pleasing, but very important. I mean, she really takes to my ear what it means to be a psychoanalyst and deeply demonstrates what our work off the couch is without losing any of the nuance that all the hard work to learn this skill requires of us. It's I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. Here's my conversation with Dr. Alexandra Harrison. Alex, welcome to the podcast. I'm so glad you're able to be with us. Alex, I have learned about your activities over the past while, and I'm so glad you're here to share it with our audience, because they will be, I think, as moved as I have been. You are the president and co-founder of an organization called Supporting Child Caregivers, SCC. Mm-hmm. And the organization is just what its name says. You support child caregivers in a host of ways. When someone goes online and sees SCC website, you will see that you have a blog, you have a podcast. The podcast covers a host of activities involved in child care, from breastfeeding to discipline to how to manage screen time. You talk about polyvagal theory. You talk about remote learning and stressors on the brain. You really cover all the things that parents and caregivers are concerned and confused about. And you speak about it in a very accessible, though expert way, which is a rare combination. But you don't only have a podcast. You also have webinar series. You have a training program for student nurses. I mean, you're really, you've done a very deep dive in how do we help people care for children. The best summary I can come up with is off your website. Let me read it, which describes SCC. It says, quote, "The primary tasks of a child caregiver are to protect, nurture, and enjoy the child. And the mission of SCC is to offer training and educational support to child caregivers. Towards this end, SCC provides useful and current scientific knowledge about child development and mental health in order to aid them in their work with children and families." Close quote. Now, this would be a meaningful, dare say, full-time activity if this took place in the suburbs of Boston, where you live and work. In fact, as we're going to hear in detail, these activities take place in El Salvador and Peru, in North India, and in Pakistan, which makes it, shall we say, more challenging. But to someone learning about this, it's quite clear that this is a labor of love for you. It could be nothing else. But another labor of love for you is to think deeply about such activities. You are both a person who does things and a person who also thinks about things. And in thinking about this labor of love, you've written about the subject of altruism. You have a paper in 2017 in the journal Psychoanalytic Inquiry. And I'd like to read the final sentence from that paper and then invite you to share your thoughts about altruism before we then go into more detail about your work in El Salvador. Your final sentence is, quote, "I am suggesting that altruism is not merely sublimation of inner conflict, but it is an adaptive, evolutionarily beneficial attitude and behavior that expands the individual's repertoire for repairing mismatches within the self. Not only does it make one feel better to make something better for someone else, but it can also produce personal growth." Close quote. Alex, tell us about altruism and your work.
Well, first of all, I wanted to thank you for that really beautiful introduction, Harvey. I couldn't have imagined a nicer way of describing what I try to do, and you're right, it is a labor of love. But I'll start my comments about altruism with a small joke, and that is, when my husband and I are driving, he's driving, and we approach a red light, he will often let someone in ahead because he knows that it won't cost him anything.
Right.
And that's a good way of starting a discussion of altruism.
Okay.
because altruism is really always has a benefit to the self. But hopefully it's a benefit to the self that is not selfish, you know. It really creates a repair, because I think all of us have small ruptures, or maybe some of us have larger ruptures within our sense of self that are caused by painful experiences in our history, times that we made mistakes that we really regret, and painful experiences we had with other people in which we felt harmed or injured. You know, and so I think that some of these remain within us, and doing good things for other people, helping other people out without a direct reward, I think gives us a different kind of reward. It gives us an experience of healing.
Let me ask you a little further about that. Mm-hmm. One often hears it said, and life experience teaches, that it does feel good to care for other people, assuming that caring is self-respecting as well. But you take it a little further. You're a little more precise than that phrase suggests. And that is, you say it feels good because it repairs ruptures.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say a little more about how you think that happens?
Well, I have adapted and developed the developmental theory of my good friend and very valued colleague, Ed Tronick, who talks about how people grow through, in a nonlinear way, through a process of repair of mismatches. Mismatches that begin in the earliest relationship with a first caregiver, but then continue to be experienced throughout the life. And what you really learn is not to necessarily avoid those mismatches or rupture experiences, but how to repair them. And people learn better or worse. But life gives us the opportunity to learn how to repair better. And psychoanalysis is a wonderful way of repairing those ruptures, but also giving to others and helping others is a way that we can continue to do that in our ordinary life.
And I think it's fair to say it's characteristic of caregivers, clinicians, physicians in general, mental health workers, and certainly analysts, that we can all locate the need for repair in our past.
Mm-hmm.
And we have found a very adaptive way to do it, as your work demonstrates.
Yeah. Well, I was brought up by two very young idealistic parents who had humanitarian values and talked about them all the time in real life, and were also quite spiritual. So, and I do believe that we learn a lot about our values. We grow our values from early on through what we experience with our parents. But you know, they those values have always been important guides in my life. They influenced my decision to go to medical school, even though I fell in love with art history when I was an undergraduate and almost changed my mind.
And you find yourself in El Salvador. I'm jumping here. And you've been in El Salvador 15 years, is that right?
Maybe even more, because now I've renewed my connection to El Salvador with a wonderful set of collaborations there.
Yes. Yes. It's hard to pick out one area of all your activities, but let's walk us through your work in El Salvador, how you began there, what you were looking for, what you've learned, and how it's evolved to this day, working with an orphanage.
Okay. Well, to begin with, I was fortunate enough to be invited into the Boston Process of Change Study Group that Daniel Stern started when he was doing a sabbatical in Boston. And there I was introduced to the world of infant research, which was fascinating to me. I learned how all sorts of things about early development. I became much more sophisticated in my understanding of development, and I also learned about videotape and the analysis of videotape in order to understand how to support the relationship. So I had also learned how to do consultation when I was in a first-year resident in psychiatry. I volunteered at the Children's Hospital in the craniofacial clinic, which was a very powerful transformational experience for me, a wonderful one. I learned how to be a good consultant, so I thought to myself, okay, here I am in Cambridge treating wonderful families, but really almost all middle to upper middle class families. Maybe I could bring some of these tools to a lower resourced community. So I happened to meet the director of an orphanage in El Salvador at a family event. And I asked if I could visit, and she said yes. And so I went down with a good friend of mine, and we visited that orphanage, and I was captured by the opportunity to offer my information. Of course, that was one of the wonderful mistakes that I made in the beginning, was thinking that I had information to offer them, you know, full of enthusiasm about what I just learned, you know, about the power of the relationship to do everything and how to use videotape to prove that. And so
now, let me ask you a question, because as I hear you taking the knowledge that you've had and then wanting to bring it to people who presumably don't have that knowledge and could benefit from it, I'm interested to hear how that turns into a mistake, because it sounds like an all good thing for everybody.
Oh, no.
Apparently, that was not the case.
It does turn out to be in the end. It's sort of like an enactment in psychoanalysis, is that, you know, I wanted to show the caregivers that they could support the development of the young children in the orphanage by strengthening the relationship they had with them. And so I gave a workshop, and my colleagues in Boston said, well, these caregivers, they don't have much education. They really won't be able to understand, certainly not a PowerPoint. And so I said, well, that's all I know how to do. So I went down with my PowerPoint, and I was immensely touched because the caregivers appeared in their Sunday best, and they took notes and everything, even though they did have very minimal education. And after I was finished, they said, and I went with a colleague, a wonderful colleague. I always go with wonderful colleagues. And the caregiver said very politely, well, we really like your talk, but now we would like you to talk to the children and tell them they must listen to us. And I realized that it really hadn't made a dent at all. This was one of many experiences I've had, and one of the reasons, you know, you said that I travel all over, and that may be exhausting, but it is so enriching, because another one of my values is the value of being surprised. And you know, apropos that wonderful old Theodore Reich paper, that we as analysts do value surprise. And
sure.
I tie it into my sense of that rupture, you know, because when you're thrown off balance, you have to right yourself, and that's a kind of repair. And also because when I was an undergraduate, I studied medieval art of the 12th century in Western Europe, and that is full of these wonderful surprises. But anyway, so I went home, and I realized that I had to do something different. And so the next time I came down, my colleague and I decided to, since these caregivers wanted to know how to discipline, that we would show them good discipline. And as a matter of fact, that is something that I talk about to parents all the time now, is good discipline and how good discipline can help their children grow and develop in healthy ways. And it does, of course. That's the spoiler alert, is that it all depends on the relationship. But what I did was, my colleague and I, we took videos of children in action with the caregivers, and we saw many instances in which the caregiver's relationship with the child supported the child's compliance with the caregiver's directives. So we showed those videotapes to the caregivers, and we showed them the good things they were doing. We didn't show them anything that we might have considered mistakes. Of course, that again is one of those wonderful surprises that you get when you come from another culture. You don't really know what a mistake is in that culture. Anyway, so we showed them that to the caregivers, these videos, and they really liked them and they enjoyed it. And over the years, the evaluations of the workshops grew. And instead of saying, now talk to the children and tell them to listen, they started to say things like, now I know I have to get down to the child's level. I have to take it more slowly. I have to express an interest in what they're doing first before I insist they do what I'm telling them to do, and things like that. And of course, my relationship with the wonderful director has grown over the years. And so that's been a very great experience. Unfortunately, that particular children's home sort of attenuated because of this law in El Salvador. But now I'm fortunate enough to be collaborating with some other institutions in the same city.
And you've been able to follow the growth of children over the years?
Yes. As a matter of fact, the same children that I saw as infants are adolescents and young adults.
Oh, how wonderful.
And they still live in this same children's home. They just, the home hasn't been able to accept any new ones.
And have your sort of unwritten predictions in your mind when you met them at young ages, when you imagined what they will turn out to be as teenagers, how good a predictor have you found yourself to be?
Well, I guess I would have two answers. One is that I'm a terrible predictor, but actually, because I have embraced a nonlinear model of development, which really suggests that all growth and change is unpredictable, I feel all right about that.
There's a virtue in being a terrible
predictor. Yeah, there is. Yeah. I really love that part of nonlinear theory, that principle. But on the other hand, one thing I did notice was that all of the children had some difficulty in school, one kind or another. And I traced that back with my new knowledge of development to the fact that they had experienced neglect and abuse in early childhood and chronic stress. And that was really what influenced me to move more into preventive work in low to moderate income countries or low income countries.
Did your work demonstrate that, in fact, trauma is as widespread as we are led to believe?
Yes. At first, you know, I I'm kind of ambivalent about cliches. Sometimes
right.
I like
that's
them.
That's why I ask it, right.
But in the beginning, I used to say, oh, everybody's saying trauma because it's the latest thing, sure. You know, it's in vogue now. But now I really have changed my tune, and I think that extreme or chronic stress, depending on the context, of course, is a powerful shaper of our lives and of how the competencies we develop in life, especially very early on. And so that's why I have really devoted myself to supporting caregivers to help them support the infant-parent relationship. Of course, caregivers includes parents, but when I go to developing countries, I focus on the people who are there because they're the ones who will be supporting the first relationship.
And your goal is to both change the melodies of the relationships that the caregivers and the parents have with the children to both prevent trauma and also to offer a reparative song, if you will, in the face of trauma. Is that
That's a wonderful question because it does also introduce the notion of song, which is a particular interest of mine. I always, when we offer an intervention to the families, to the usually it's mother and infant, I always ask the mother if she will sing a song to her baby. Hmm. But I think that it's not. Oh my gosh, can you remind me again? I was so interested in your bringing up the word song, music,
sure,
that I forgot what the focus of your question
well,
was.
Well, it sounds like you're trying to address two levels of difficulty, one of which is to establish relationships that will prevent trauma.
Oh,
and
yes,
when
right.
trauma has already occurred, to establish relationships that, like with altruism, will remediate it.
Well, you know, preventing trauma is very hard to do, especially the social and economic roots of trauma in these countries. For example, one time I came to do an infant parent mental health workshop with my colleague in South India, and the women said, one of the women stood up and said, "My husband was killed in an alcoholic brawl last night. I don't want to hear about anything until you do something about the alcoholism in our community." Hmm. And chronic poverty and domestic violence and all of these plagues that occur, especially in countries that have already experienced trauma. For example, El Salvador had a recent terrible civil war, and the people are still traumatized by that, both from their recent memory, well, or not so recent memory, but also epigenetically, they're traumatized. But I think that what you can do is alert people to the need to protect the infant's early development, neurodevelopment, as well as they can. And now there's accumulating evidence that a strong, responsive infant-parent relationship is somewhat protective against the stress in the environment. So that's what we try to do. But also, you know, it's just like everything. You have to moderate your own expectations. Otherwise, you will be so discouraged, you will stop work.
Sure.
And so one wonderful translator, colleague of mine in El Salvador, coined the term magic moments, momentos mágicos, when I was describing, I was reaching for some way of describing why it's so important that the caregivers, that we capture these moments between the child and the caregiver that work well, and showing it to them in videotape. And she came up with this term, which was so good, because especially moving again to nonlinear systems principles, if you accumulate magic moments, you can really be hopeful that over time they will grow and grow. And even though you can't predict it, you can't predict when or exactly or how, it's possible that there will be a positive change. And so that's one of the ways I try to help caregivers of these families in these dire circumstances be hopeful and not get too discouraged. I always tell them to look for the magic moments.
Do you feel that, for example, that woman whose husband was killed, do you feel that the processes you're putting in place can help a mourning process on her part? You can't prevent certain tragedies, obviously, but for any of us, but you can in some way facilitate a working through of it to some degree, which would pass it along to the next generation less.
Well, it's an interesting question. I don't think that I could do that with her, nor even my local colleague could do that with her. I think what she's really asking is something that we as psychoanalysts are not used to providing, and that is concrete help. But what I did was, my colleague is connected in the community, which is why I always make that kind of collaboration. And she was able to identify another nonprofit that worked with alcohol abuse prevention in that neighborhood. But I think really that one part of the magic, speaking again of magic, of infancy, is that there is a kind of opportunity for healing in the infant-parent relationship. That is, when the parent sees her child and his child, when they see their child, their newborn child, there is the myth of the Messiah, which is full of hope, you know, in every culture, no matter what you call it. And they think this could be the beginning of something better. And so you support them in that thought, and you say, yes, there is something wonderful about this child. And you as his or her parents, really have a connection to that wonder. And we can help you learn how to hold on to that and help this child grow.
Do you encounter, speaking of having a new child and what psychoanalysts can offer, do you encounter depression and postpartum depression on a regular basis? Is that something that you have a sense of? And can you advise treatment for these things in addition to psychological treatment, medication treatment?
That's a really important question. As a matter of fact, right now, some of my young colleagues and I are working on a submission to the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry meetings that has to do with the ignorance about perinatal mental health, which of course includes postpartum depression and baby blues and also postpartum psychosis. Mm-hmm. But it turns out, you will not be surprised to hear, that the incidence of postpartum depression is significantly higher in the context of poverty and other social adversity, so that it's in countries where I go, it's the incidence is about 1 in 5 mothers. And of course, it occurs, for example, even if it remits, as it often does, after 6 months, it occurs at a time when the infant is growing, the infant brain is growing more rapidly than at any other time in life, and needs the nurturing of that relationship more than at any other time. So as much as we can help during that time, we do. But you're right. I mean, for example, in Pakistan, where we see most of the mothers and babies these days, the opportunity to get treated for that postpartum depression is medically is very slight in the villages where we like to go. So what I have been doing is developing a set of videotaped dialogues between two pretend Pakistani South Asian women at various stages of pregnancy talking to each other. And these dialogues emphasize the value of not only reaching out to health workers, which I include in the dialogues, but also the value of women supporting other women, of mm-hmm. these two friends saying to each other things like, I'm so glad I have you to talk to, because otherwise I'm not sure I could take care of myself during this time, and things like that. So yeah, I think we as analysts really need to use our psychoanalytic understanding of the value of the inner life of every individual and of the value of growth and development that occurs in a relationship. We need to use that kind of knowledge to find alternative ways other than the intensive treatment we offer in our offices, not only in developing countries, but also in our own country.
Yes. That's a beautiful example of the theme of this podcast is really just that, psychoanalysis off the couch. That is how we take what we learn in the office and about ourselves and in the inner workings of our minds, and how we use that knowledge, not necessarily providing the in-depth experiences that we commonly think of, but doing just what you said, which is to take that knowledge and figure out a way to apply it in these other settings, which you've done. Tell us about Pakistan. You mentioned your new activities there.
I really have wonderful experiences there. I went once with my colleague, Mohammed Zeeshan, who is a wonderful colleague who works with me in SCC and is also a child psychiatrist. And he is Pakistani by birth, now naturalized as a U.S. citizen. But he arranged for me to meet many people there, many professionals, and to meet many others, people in villages. And we gave workshops at many hospitals. And so I felt really connected there. And then one of the wonderful people I met there is a woman, a pediatric resident named Jazia Parveen, who wanted to continue to work with us. And so we Mohammed and I guided her in doing remote newborn behavioral observations, NBO, which is a wonderful intervention developed by Barry Brazelton and his colleagues, and now part of the Brazelton Institute at Boston Children's Hospital. And we did these NBOs on Pakistani village women. And it was a very powerful experience for us because many of these women who are expected to have multiple children, and often if their child looks what they call weak, which we interpreted to mean non-viable, that these women were afraid that they didn't have permission to invest in them, in the nurturing of these children. So the NBO, which is called another one of those cliches, but a kind of useful one, strength-based, which means that it identifies the infant's strengths, as well as pointing out some of the sensitivities of that infant. When we were able to identify some of the baby's strengths to these mothers, we saw them transformed into a joyful face and a hopeful attitude, because now they had the expert's opinion that their baby deserved to be nurtured and cared for and maybe had a future. And one of the most interesting things about it is that there's one item in the NBO item list intervention, which is you place the baby on prone and you notice that the infant, and these are newborns mostly, they make little proto-crawling movements. And that had a powerful effect of all the babies that Shazia did. Of course, this was remotely because Mohammed and I were on Zoom with her. They made little crawling movements. And I thought afterwards that they said this made them think their baby was strong. And I agreed. But I thought that it also gave these mothers a kind of view into the fact that the babies had a future. The babies would crawl and then they would walk. You know, that these babies could live, they could survive. And you can imagine that's a very powerful experience.
It's such a beautiful example of, again, to turn it into a cliche, of using the transference. That is, that they have endowed you with powers.
That's true.
And you sort of bless the child, mm-hmm. and you bless them and their interaction, and they smile.
Yes,
and
when they imagine having two doctors from the United States come into your clinic or into your home. Right. But I just have to tell you one short story because we're probably almost out of time. There was one home we went into in Pakistan in which after the NBO was done, the father was holding the baby, and he said, and Shazia asked this wonderful question. She said, "What do you hope for the future for your little son?" This is a newborn. And the father said, "I want him to become a pilot." And Shazia said, "A pilot?" And he said, "Yes, so he can see the world." And then I thought, here we were coming from across the world into his home, and he wanted his son to have a similar experience, to be able to travel.
And if you had an Anna Lassand tell that story, you would think to yourself, and at some point perhaps comment about the identification that it was reflecting. And there was no need to comment on it. It just lived. It lived as a seedling of a future that they might not otherwise have.
But isn't that true? And it does make you think about psychoanalytic education, doesn't it? How much do we have to teach our students to name things in their work?
As opposed to let them thrive, you mean?
Yes, also recognize them. Recognize them,
quietly. Sure. So what you're saying is you're turning the theme of this podcast on its head. Not only is this psychoanalyst, like you're going to El Salvador, bringing the great wisdom down there only to learn that it's not a one direction. Now you're saying that, in fact, we're learning from your interaction and we're bringing it back here to maybe reflect on our own education and learning as psychoanalysts.
Well, we do need to look at our psychoanalytic teaching, that's for sure.
Always. And we always should. I think we are, and trying many different things and going in new directions, some of which will, like your activities, bear fruit and some of which need to be tweaked. But all of what we do should be, to use that word, blessed by your gracefulness, Alex. It's really...
Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure to hear you talk about your work. It's a pleasure to learn about your work.
Well, and it's such an honor to have been invited.
And for those who are listening who have interest in this and want to either participate or learn, go to the website. Again, it's supporting child caregivers. And you will see this laid out in front of you. It's really magnificent. Alex, thank you for sharing your time and your thought and your graciousness with us. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you, Harvey.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.